Welcome. This is William Evans, and you are listening to a Living World Conversation. Our guest today is Barbara Dills. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Will. I'm delighted to be here.
Lovely to have you here. As a child, your family moved about, but you mostly grew up in Connecticut.
That's correct.
And there you had a neighbor who introduced you to gardening.
Yes. Our next-door neighbor, he was quite a gardener, and he helped me put in my first tomato plants and till up a little bit of our backyard.
And then you became a religious studies major at Smith with an emphasis on Buddhism.
That's correct.
At age 21, at the invitation of your boyfriend, you drove your red used VW Bug to the Rosebud Lakota Reservation and spent the summer there cooking and beginning to heal.
That's a big part of what it was, yes.
And the people there saw how much you needed healing.
I didn't know I did, but they saw it.
And they opened the door to you.
They welcomed me into every one of their ceremonies and into their daily life, yes.
And that was the doorway to Wo Lakota.
Wo Lakota, at the time I didn't know that phrase, but Wo Lakota means the Lakota way. It encompasses all of their way of living, their way of life, yes.
Yes, Orville Looking Horse spoke of Wo Lakota when I talked to him.
Yeah, I'm sure it's how he, what the umbrella he's lived under his whole life, really.
So that summer was the beginning of a continuing deep and profound relationship with the Sichangu Lakota. And in 1982, you and your son were adopted by Leonard Crowdog.
Well, I was adopted by the family. He performed the ceremony at the Sundance that summer. But the way those adoptions work, you really are adopted as in a relation to a certain person. And so I was adopted as a sister to his niece, which made me his niece also.
As an adopted member of those people, will you kindly read their words to us?
I will, and the words I'm going to read are, I just want to be clear, not the Crow Dog's words. They are the words of the absolutely wonderful organization that is working on Rosebud now called Sichangu Co. And so it is their theme, if you will, and we'll talk more about the programs that they're doing. But I just want to be clear that these words don't come directly to me from the Crow Dogs.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're more a proclamation of the people.
Absolutely. Yeah. These are very, this is a very common, the common phrase, and then the words that have been adopted from the Lakota into English that are on their website. Yeah. So shall I read that?
Please.
Yeah. So first, this general phrase that is very commonly referred to, which is Nake Nula Wa'un, and it means, I am always ready, or I am always prepared. And so Sichangu Co. has adopted that to inspire everyone in the community, but also everyone who works there to do their best and to always be prepared for whatever comes, because their people have had to deal with so much that has come. And they've survived it and now are, you know, really moving forward with their culture.
Give us the translation again.
So the translation would be, I am always ready or prepared for anything at any time.
Yes.
And then it goes, what goes on is, at least on the website, they have sort of extracted this lovely proclamation, really. And it says, we are Sichangu. We see a world where we are healthy and whole in body, mind, and spirit, connected to the earth and stars and all our relations. We are living that world into being. And then I just wanted to say, in case there are any hip-hop fans out there, that there's also a young, rising hip-hop band from Rosebud of Sichangu, young Sichangu men. And they dance too, but anyway, and they've taken the name Nake Nula Waun as their band name.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I'd forgotten that until I dug into it a little bit for this interview.
So you entered into that world, and simultaneously you raised your son and worked in a variety of jobs in the corporate world and were based much of the time in Oregon.
That's correct.
And then your son attended CRMS, and Carbondale caught your eye.
Carbondale did. It caught my heart, I think, actually, as happens to a fair number of CRMS parents, I will say. But I did not live here when my son was in school. He probably would have kicked me out of the valley. but years later, yeah, I just, you know, I was ready to leave the wet, soggy Pacific Northwest for higher altitude and sunshine. And Carbondale had always spoken to me. So I moved here in very late 2011.
And when you moved here, you connected with Laura Bartels.
I did. She was one of the first people that I really met. Yeah. At an event at the Third Street Center where there was a Lakota drum and dance group performing.
And simultaneously, Laura was helping the Sikandru people learn about straw bale housing.
Well, she had done that, but she wasn't actively doing it at the time I met her, but she had been out working at the tribal college there, giving classes and teaching people, yes.
And she continued to make trips there.
That's right. She got hired in a slightly different capacity to actually facilitate a series of community meetings, because she had great facilitation skills, as she still does. And yes, and so through a strange set of circumstances that we don't have to go into in great detail, but I ended up out there with her and being asked to be the photographer for those community meetings. Yes.
And that began to be the entree you needed to manifest what your prayer had been, and that was give back to these people who had given to you.
True. I had, you know, stayed very close to what they call the Teoshpe that I was adopted into, Teoshpe meaning extended family. And but, you know, I would send people grocery money or gas money or help with propane for when they didn't have heat in the house and things like that. But I had always longed to take the skills I learned in all these jobs I didn't love, take some of these skills back to the community in a way that would have broader and deeper, in some ways, influence on their, you know, situation of poverty and injustice and all of that. So through Laura, I got introduced to this rather remarkable opportunity that was just emerging. The tribe had rebought 600 acres of land to develop for community need, to address community needs. And that's what those community meetings were about that Laura helped facilitate. They were organized so that the community could give input into what were the priorities for utilizing these beautiful 600 acres along a lovely creek, right in the center of activity of the reservation.
And so you saw that through the photographer's lens, but also connected to it with your heart, and then came home and pondered.
That's true, and thought, okay.
What those priorities mean.
Right, and at the top of the communities list were, among other things, but these were key elements, were some kind of community garden or agricultural endeavor that would address the dire need for healthy, fresh food. I'd been going there for almost, you know, now it's been 51 years, but I'd been going there a long time. And you were lucky if you found iceberg lettuce wrapped in a plastic wrapper in the grocery stores. There was very little produce, fresh produce, and definitely not local produce available. So anyway, that was very high on the list, as was affordable housing, because there is such a dire housing and homelessness, unhoused, you know, crisis there, I should say. Not really homelessness, because Lakota people take in their relatives when they don't have anywhere to live. So it ends up being that the housing situation is dire, in part because it impacts those people who do have housing, but then end up taking in 6, 8, 10 relatives to share what are small, poorly built homes.
And you had, at Smith, had experiences where you saw and experienced poverty, but this was a different level.
Yeah, actually, it was in high school. Well, it was prior to Smith, even. When I was between my junior and senior year in high school, through my congregational church, a group of us very young women had an opportunity to start a day camp in the South Bronx of New York, in New York City. And so, yes, we had done that. And I say to people, you know, I had seen the impact of poverty, urban poverty, but the level of poverty I experienced in 1974 on the Rosebud Reservation was beyond what I had seen in the city. I think that's what you're thinking about, yeah.
And the other detail to maybe put into the context is that you arrived at Rosebud as a vegetarian.
This is true. It didn't last long, but
this is KDNK, and you're listening to A Living World Conversation with Barbara Dills. Tell us what's growing at Rosebud.
Well, I have to admit that since COVID, I have not been out there. So I can't say for sure what's growing at Rosebud in terms of the actual plants in the garden. But I can tell you that they are expanding. So let me back up a little bit and just say that when I came back and pondered these 600 acres, I went to a very talented young man who was running the arm of the tribe that had been charged with developing those 600 acres. And his name is Wheezy Pond Little Elk Garriott. And I said to him, it could take you 10 or 15 years to build houses out there. And I know from experience how many times projects have tried to start well-meaning projects on the reservation through churches and other, you know, philanthropic organizations, and maybe they go for a year or two and then the people leave because it's too hard. And so the community is rather cynical when they hear, oh, we're going to have 600 acres, it's going to be beautiful, it's going to have this or that. There's a cynicism and a lack of belief. And so I said to him, it could take you 10 or 15 years to build houses, but we could do a garden right now. And he said, do it. So began my stint trying to take my own community gardening experiences in Oregon, which I'd been a community gardener for 15 years, and figure out what we could do with an acre. And he and I walked the property and marked what could be the acre. And now, of course, the gardeners tease me because the wind is quite dramatic in that spot. So they're like, it would have been nice if you'd put it a little bit lower down in the slope. But in any case, we got grant money to fence an acre. We fenced an acre. We found somebody to be our on-site garden manager. And he's just done a great job and now has been elevated into a much broader position with the organization. But anyway, we started a garden and it has taken off to the point that now they have a dome greenhouse, just like the one here at the high school in Carbondale. And they have high tunnels, and they are growing all kinds of food and bringing kids in from the schools into that teaching greenhouse. And, you know, they have chickens, and they And the garden is now in the process of being expanded to five more acres.
Explain for us kindly how that garden evolved into a whole food sovereignty initiative and the importance of sovereignty to Native people.
Well, yeah, the garden, you know, like Will just said, it started out, you know, just being a food producing, and then they started a farmer's market, which is one of the three largest farmer's markets in the state of South Dakota now. And so then the farmer's market was the next thing. And then they started offering cooking class. They partnered with the tribally owned grocery store, which is also out on that property. And they started having food demonstrations in the grocery store and offering cooking classes and, you know, getting garden supplies so people could have gardens at their homes, which is really something that's taken off. So having interns in the summer, learning not only the gardening skills, but also all kinds of life skills. And so it has evolved into this much larger, how do we take control of our diets and our food and our health, because diabetes and heart disease are very, very impactful there, and a lot the result of the processed food diets people have been forced into by virtue of not having other options. So yeah, so now there's a great, much more consciousness of health through eating, and it's really impacting the whole community. So this evolved into something bigger, so they have sort of renamed the gardening project the Sichangu Food Sovereignty Initiative. And in 2020, I think it was, in 2020, they applied for recognition from the Rockefeller Foundation, and in an international competition, they were one of only two organizations in the United States and three in North America who got these awards for their work, along with people from Japan and China and all different countries around the world. So I think there were hundreds of applicants and only 25 or something chosen. So yeah, it's an internationally recognized food sovereignty program now.
And to tie that to Wolokota, when I look at that page in the website, Food Sovereignty Initiative, right underneath it says, restoring our sacred connection to food. And do you want to say anything more about that sacred perspective of what's done in the garden, as well as the whole relationship with the buffalo?
Sure. This could be a long conversation, but I'll try to compress it here for us. So foods, particularly in ceremonial contexts, have been very important. And, when people didn't have a lot to eat, pre-contact, at certain times of the year, then they would come together for, ceremony, and people would be fed. You're always fed at a ceremony. So there are ceremonial traditional foods that are still somewhat plentiful on the prairie. So I want to say that this Food Sovereignty Initiative is not just about cultivated garden goods. They dig timsala, which is the traditional wild turnip. They harvest choke cherries. They harvest wild plums. And now they're planting all of those traditional foods in this larger garden and down by the creek. So there are many, many, many traditional foods that are incorporated and that are considered very sacred because they go back so long in history and sustained these people through so many generations before the reservation period. Food in general, but everything in life really is under Wolokota. There was a Wolokota way of doing so many things. And the buffalo were, of course, a key part of that. The Lakota people really feel that they've evolved from the buffalo, that the buffalo is their brethren, their sister. And so the Rosebud, the Sichanguko organization, now shepherds what is becoming the largest tribally owned buffalo herd in North America, but possibly the largest native owned buffalo herd in the world. So now they're integrating the buffalo that they're able to harvest from their own herd into this larger food sovereignty initiative. And my adopted sister Sharon, which is how I was adopted to the Crow Dog Teochpe, she has been able to bring her knowledge as a traditional Lakota woman to this project, in terms of she's a master butcherer. She knows how to use and save every part of the animal. She also knows how to cook all the old traditional ceremonial foods. So she now brings that knowledge, as do other elders, into this program.
Beautiful.
Which has kind of been a beautiful full circle for me.
Sure. And it's all under the umbrella of Wo Lakota, which means peace, balance, and coming together.
How to live in that way, yes. And then there's a word under that that I'll just share really briefly, which is Wichozani. And Wichozani is the daily way of life to have health in mind, body, and spirit.
So the health of the Lakota people, and specifically the Sichangu people, is blossoming.
It is blossoming, and we don't often hear about these glorious projects that are going on in Indian country now, but many tribes are really in a revitalization process. And yeah, I would encourage anyone interested, you know, you can learn more about this particular project at the website sichangu.co, and Sichangu is spelled S-I-C-A-N-G-U. So yeah, there's lots of information there about all of their different initiatives.
And you made the transition to not being a vegetarian.
I did. I had little choice, or I would have starved that summer, and I actually learned how to butcher, sort of. It was cows, though, at that time, because the buffalo herd, this is 1974, the tribe had no buffalo. Unfortunately, most of the agricultural land was in the hands of, you know, the descendants of settlers who'd been given it during the prior century to come and develop. Yeah, most of it was in white hands.
And so this Rosebud Economic Development Company is a major presence in Rosebud.
Absolutely. And that was the prior name of the whole organization. And then they created for-profit arm. And then they created a nonprofit community development corporation and also a lending bank. So those three entities now are under this larger umbrella of Sichanguko. But it was initially the Rosebud Economic Development Corporation that was spearheading all these initiatives, and now it's a part of it. But they have many for-profit businesses that are taking revenue and putting it back into the tribe and into these projects. And, you know, they have a propane company, so that it's not white outsiders selling propane. They have a office supply company, so the tribe is not buying office supplies and spending a lot of money. They're able to get wholesale. And, you know, they're very, very creative. They have many different businesses under their umbrella.
The problems that we know can exist and do exist are still there, but there's a healthy growth balancing that out. And because it's so effective and permeating the educational system, the children have a greater chance.
Yeah, it's really quite phenomenal, the transformation I've seen, especially in the last 10 years. And this project, this 600-acre project, is just an emblem of it, but it's much wider spread across the tribal government. And it's really a revitalization, a regeneration of the culture is happening.
And we saw that manifest in the widespread support at the Dakota Access Pipeline camp.
Absolutely. And prior to that, the Keystone XL blocking and protests, which a lot of it centered actually on Rosebud treaty land, which is not specifically within the reservation bounds. But yes, the Rosebud tribe has been, and the Rosebud people, the Sichangu people, they prefer to be referred to by their traditional band name, not by the reservation name, but the Sichangu people were very involved in supporting the no Dakota Access Pipeline project or protests up in Standing Rock.
If listeners want to learn more about what's happening with the Sichangu people or support their story, how would they do that?
So the best way really is just to look through this beautiful website, Sichangu.co, and
spell Sichangu for them.
Sichangu, and then a dot, and then co, not com, but co. Yeah. So you can learn more there and contact anybody there. They have a very strong marketing and development team who are really involved in getting out the message about what's happening there. So there are lots of good people who will respond.
It's been inspiring. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you for having me, Will.
You've been listening to A Living World Conversation with Barbara Dills. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.